Good evening. My name is Lina Isabel Stockfish, and on behalf of the America Zentrum Hamburg, I welcome you to tonight's event. We at the America Zentrum are dedicated to German-American cultural exchange since 1997 and supported by the U.S. Embassy and the German Office of Foreign Affairs. Our philosophy is to focus on the benefits this binational friendship entails culturally as well as politically. Hence, it is our mission to further this wonderful friendship through partnerships, cooperation, exchanges and events such as today. As such, we are hosting this event dedicated to George Washington's legacy as well as the contemporary political climate in the US. Today's event is part of the Road to Election series hosted by the Aspen Institute. This digital event series is running from January 2024 to January 2025 and is hosting a variety of discussions and fostering an exchange of ideas leading up to the 2024 US general election. As a collaboration of over 25 transatlantic organizations and political foundations, this series aims to inform, to engage in dynamic dialogues, and to champion democratic values by presenting diverse perspectives. The initiative's event will feature prominent researchers, policymakers, commentators, and civil society representatives exploring diverse formats and a wide array of topics. From public polling and media impact to electoral demographics, the future of the US democracy, and pressing policy issues like trade and immigration. The Road to Election series aims to offer insight for audiences in both the United States and Germany. For more information, you can visit the initiative's website, roadtoelection.de. Leading you through today's event is Gottfried Hauber. He works as a freelance event and radio presenter, cultural manager, and author. As a trained historian, English scholar, and educationalist, many of his interests lie in the field of educational and mediation projects of all kinds. However, topics relating to art and culture, social cooperation, innovation, and future prospects also play an important role for him. Our guest today is Thomas Zimmer, who is an historian and has been a DAAD visiting professor at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. since 2021. He was previously an academic counselor at the University of Freiburg. He's interested in the history of American democracy and its opponents, especially anti-democratic tendencies in modern conservatism since the 1930s. He is currently working on a book project entitled Trumpism and American History, in which he locates the current radicalization of the American right in the longer lines of US history. He also writes Democracy Americana, a weekly newsletter on American politics, and is host to This Is Democracy podcast. This event today will be recorded. Thank you for coming today, and I will now hand over to Gottfried Hauber and Thomas Zimmer.
Thank you very much, Lina, for those kind words of welcome and introduction. And first of all, from my point of view and for my desktop here, welcome to everybody watching, listening to us. I'm very happy to be here. I'm very happy to be doing this with the America Zentrum together. Thank you very much already at this stage for doing this, for hosting this. And I'm also very, very happy to be talking to Thomas Zimmer today because we actually have missed each other, just missed each other at Freiburg University. We were both there. You were working there. I was a couple of years younger, so I was just finishing my studies, and then you left, and I was like, no, I hadn't gotten the chance to talk to you about the last election. Actually, it was back in 2020 when we were just on the point of meeting for the like. Properly meeting for the first time, and then we missed that opportunity. And I was very happy that you agreed to do the talk today, Thomas. Great that you're here.
Thank you for having me. I wish we had more, positive things to discuss, but it is what it is.
It is what it is. And funnily enough, when Lina just introduced us and the backdrop of the whole setting of today, and obviously of Road to Election by the Aspen Institute events and the program, and also the idea of the America Zentrum, the idea is to have partnership, to talk about things of mutual interest. Full transparency. When I was planning to do this with the America Zentrum, let's say 8, 9 months ago, we were planning on talking about George Washington, right? Because it's his 225th death day this year in December, and then we talked about let's do this before the election because it might be a nice idea to have a historical background to what is happening. And then we planned this, and actually we planned this until yesterday. So yesterday things kind of shifted and changed and in many ways. So what we're going to do in the next 45 minutes to 60 minutes is we're going to do this. We're going to have a historical overview of the bumps along the way of US democracy, of the history of the US democracy, and where the democracy has been challenged before. But we can't really do that without addressing the elephant in the room, without setting the table. And Thomas, this is where I hand over to you. Set the table for us. Where are we when we talk about, or when we are going to look back at where US democracy comes from, where we come from over the last 250 years, roughly? Where are we now, ever since yesterday?
I'll take a deep breath before I get started. So
Yes.
yesterday, I'm assuming most people will have heard about this. The Supreme Court came down with the long-awaited ruling on whether or not President, specifically whether or not Donald Trump, is immune from criminal prosecution. And the Supreme Court, in a 6-3 decision along partisan lines, with a decision written by Chief Justice John Roberts, ruled yesterday that presidents. And again, the president in question here is Trump, because this is about January 6th and Trump's role in the attempt to nullify the results of a democratic election, are actually immune from criminal prosecution for all, he calls it, official acts, defining official acts in such a broad way and also hampering any investigation of presidents so severely that this ruling basically amounts to near total immunity for Trump and all future presidents. Well, you know, only those who have the approval of this particular Supreme Court majority. I am, and I don't know how else to say this, shocked and shaken by this decision. I say this as someone who has no sympathy for the court. The idea that the Supreme Court has been an ally to democracy is a complete misunderstanding and a myth. It is based on a period in the 1950s and 60s, the so-called Warren Court, when it was indeed instrumental in pushing democratization, but that was the exception in the Supreme Court's history. The historical norm for this institution has been to play a reactionary role, siding with power over those without power, with wealth over those who are poor, with those who are at the top over those who are at the bottom. I have never had any illusions about the court being a nonpartisan institution standing above the political fray. That's all complete nonsense. This court, in its current iteration, has been the spearhead of a reactionary mobilization against pluralistic democracy and the modern state. And yet, all that being said, so I'm saying that because I'm trying to tell you that my expectations for this court weren't exactly lofty. And yet, all that being said, I'm shocked. And I think every serious observer, every serious analyst, every constitutional lawyer who is not a right-wing hack is shocked. This is an extreme ruling. It gets worse and worse the more you dive into it, because the decision written by John Roberts is, well, it's quite something. I'm going to give you a few examples to just make it clear how extreme this is, right? So the ruling is, again, presidents are immune for all official acts, not immune for unofficial acts. But then in his decision, Roberts defines official acts very broadly. He explicitly says, in dividing official from unofficial conduct, courts may not inquire into the president's motives. He explicitly mentions, as an example, Trump putting pressure on Pence to sabotage the certification of the 2020 election. That's totally fine, explicitly totally fine, according to this ruling, because again, the motive is irrelevant. The only thing that matters is this is official business between the president and the vice president. So no matter what the substance of that business was and what the president wanted to achieve, it's totally fine. Roberts also says that no prosecution of the president can be premised either on use of the pardon power. So again, pardon power, totally fine. You can do with it whatever you want, or the firing of an executive branch official, like for instance, a special counsel investigating the president. You can totally fire them, totally fine. Oh, and then Roberts also explicitly throws out the idea that the Department of Justice should be independent. Roberts explicitly says the president totally has the right to instruct the attorney general to investigate people. Again, I mean, I've been trying to find a limiting principle. There is none. Justice Sotomayor, in her dissent, brings up this example, like if Trump ordered SEAL Team 6 to take out a political opponent, this decision means that criminal law can't be used against him in response. I know this sounds crazy, but the president is the commander in chief. Giving orders to the military is 100% an official act as defined in this ruling. And Roberts explicitly says, if it is an official act, the question of legality is moot. It must not matter, right? Again, this is a truly extreme ruling. It's the most extreme ruling in decades. Historian Kevin Cruz has called it the most extreme Supreme Court in US history. This ruling is fundamentally incompatible with any form of democratic self-government. It is diametrically opposed to the pillars of what we call a democratic republic. And the thought of Donald Trump regaining the immense power of the presidency with this ruling now being the law of the land is, it's frightening. There's no other way to say it. It's utterly frightening.
Thanks, first of all, for this overview of where we are right now. I'd say we come back, obviously, we come back to the present in the at the end, or rather towards the end of our discussion now. And then I would also like to hear your views on what can there be done now, and why you either have hopes or you don't have hopes for the Democratic government and the president, who are still in office, remember, until November, what they can do about it and what can be done about it, right? So after everybody panicked, which everybody is doing today, yesterday and today, what can be done? Just to pave us the road to where we actually want to get started from, Biden himself, in his rebuttal, said, "May God help us protect our democracy," which I found quite interesting. Our democracy was founded on the concept of no kings, famously, and the only limits of the office of the president will now be self-imposed. From that, Thomas, take us back to a, I would now say, simpler time, if that weren't laughable in its own right. Let's connect the dots. Let's connect where we are now, or at least in the present, in the 21st century, with the very founding, with when it all got started, with the idea and also the precedent of the man who now has this special anniversary of 225 death days. That is in 1796, the election after two terms that George Washington decided to step aside. Just to frame that for us, where are we there?
So full disclosure, I'm not an early Americanist, so I'm not an expert on the early American Republic. And it's interesting when we decided we would do this, you asked me to think about this, right? Like, what is the role of Washington? What's the role of the founding? What's the role of the founding period when we think about the current state of American democracy? And my first thought is, so it's quite striking, certainly for non-American observers, as we all are. What a key role in the nation's collective imaginary the founding plays, the founding era, the founding documents, the founding fathers. It manifests in different ways, one of which is the idolizing of the founders themselves, and among them, Washington in particular. This, by the way, starts right away. I mean, there's some skepticism in the late 18th, early 19th century towards him and his legacy among Jeffersonians. But, you know, mostly, I mean, look, they're naming the new capital after him in 1791, right? So Washington, D.C. was founded in 1791, and they're naming it after Washington. So, you know, whatever level of skepticism there was, it wasn't all that much. Now, from a small d democratic perspective, Washington as a historical figure, Washington's record is complicated. And the whole founding era mythology is quite problematic in many ways, right? So, for instance, on the right and well into the mainstream of American politics, the Constitution is being treated as a quasi-religious text that must not be challenged, it must not be adapted or amended, an argument that is obviously weaponized against any attempt to create a fairer, more democratic society. As for Washington specifically, there's always been a fine line between worshiping him as a kind of heroic founder of a democratic republic and a kind of like rah-rah militant patriotism that always had a certain authoritarian dimension. And not coincidentally, Washington has often been portrayed as a kind of warrior patriarch of the nation, which is not a very democratic image, right? So Washington himself was very much aware of his role as someone who would set a precedent for what the presidency would be. He talked about this explicitly. And in some ways, he set some very democratic, important precedents, right? Including the idea that the president should not rule for longer than two terms. actually everyone at the time wanted him to keep being president. He said, no, it's actually not a good idea.
Exactly. So it would be down to him. It would have been down to him. Yeah.
Right. No, I mean, clearly, I mean, he won both his elections unanimously. I mean, with sort of unanimous approval in the Electoral College, he would have won another one. But he decided the president should not cling to power, that, you know, the president needed to ensure a peaceful transfer of power. He needed to be restrained in his use of power. So that is the good president, the good Washington, right? I mean, on the other hand, right? So I'm assuming this is not does not come as a shock to anyone. Washington was a slave owner. Throughout his life, he enslaved other human beings. There were about 300 enslaved people at Mount Vernon, where he lived, by the time of his death. He was, you know, he was a racist in the sense that he believed in the racial superiority of white people, although it is also fair to notice that white supremacy was not the animating principle of his politics. That's two different things, right? He was also, by the 1780s, he expressed doubts and reservations about slavery, but always in private. He started supporting gradual emancipation of slaves in the 1780s, again, always in private. He decreed in his will that all his slaves should be freed upon the death of his wife. That is what happened. Or actually earlier than that, because I think she then freed many of them before she died. But again, he ultimately never took a public stance against slavery. He thought that was going to be too divisive, and he didn't want to do that. If you take all this together, right, I think it really captures the very complicated history of democracy in America. It's a country that in many ways has always been defined by the conflict over how much it really wanted to be a nation in which all people were, in fact, created equal, who got to belong to the people, to whom the egalitarian promise would be extended, and who would be ultimately excluded from that egalitarian promise in service of maintaining hierarchies of race and gender and religion and wealth. And I think Washington kind of neatly encapsulates and captures that specific conflict.
You just mentioned in the beginning that obviously many people still circle back to Washington as a figure to look up to and to take that precedent from that he set by stepping aside, not just about the presidency, but also about the presidency, or Biden, who remarked again now in the light of this decision yesterday that George Washington had defined the presidency about being about character and being about being set limits and so on and so forth. So that kind of tells me that both Republicans, conservatives, but also Democrats today go back to Washington and this founding principle of what you described as everybody is equal and everybody is included from now nowadays standpoint of view. Obviously, who is included, that has changed a little. So that's on both sides of the equation, right?
Well, they don't both go back to the egalitarian principle. They both go back to the founding era, right? Mm-hmm. Interpreting it in very different ways. I think that's really important, right? Because on the right, there's a long tradition of actually sort of thinking of equality and this sort of egalitarian principle and liberty and freedom as kind of opposing principles, right? So that's a sort of a long tradition. So on the right, the dominating, if you look at the right-wing intellectuals today, especially the ones that are most closely aligned with Trump, they are obsessed with the founding period, but they don't think it's about an egalitarian principle. They think it's about freedom and equality, and they think equality is actually sort of in contrast with that, right? But yeah, it is true that it's quite striking that how much sort of this kind of history features in the political discourse over the past few years, specifically how much history, the stories we tell about it, the way we teach it, has moved to the center of the political conflict. And again, specifically the history of the founding and the founders, the flashpoint in that debate, I'm guessing many people will remember this, was the so-called 1619 project launched by the New York Times in the summer of 2019 with the aim of revising, retelling the American story by placing more of an emphasis on the role of slavery, on the Black struggle to overcome it, and sort of on their struggle to realize the vision of multiracial democracy. And then in reaction to that, a conservative counter-mobilization happened, trying to sort of re-entrench a story of the founding as this glorious moment, and a version of U.S. history focused on the good, the noble. You know, it culminated in Donald Trump's so-called 1776 commission, right? So this was a presidential advisory commission established in the fall of 2020, as a direct reaction, by the way, to the mass protest against police violence in the wake of the murder of George Floyd, with the explicit aim of imposing a patriotic history, a patriotic education on the country. So you know, these history wars, they have happened. This is not per se a new thing. The term history wars that I'm also using was actually originated in the 90s. There was a big discussion around sort of high school history curricula in the 90s. But the current history wars, they stand out in the sense that this time, this isn't confined to the level of debate. This isn't just happening in sort of the opinion pages of the New York Times. Republican-led states have enacted literally hundreds of laws mandating a celebratory version of history, outlawing anything and anyone who dares to deviate from that history, purging from the classrooms and from public libraries the works of mostly non-white authors who present a more critical perspective on America, focusing on structural racism, for instance. And so, you know, this is clearly not about academic history. This is clearly not about, you know, interpretations of history. It's all part of a broader struggle over who gets to define the national story, who gets to define national identity, who gets to draw the boundaries of what counts as America and American, and thereby sort of either stabilize or question the status quo. And so this is, I think, what this is all about, this constant recourse to history, to the founding. These history wars are very much and intimately tied to the larger political struggle that is ultimately over power and status and not over history in any sort of academic sense.
Mm. Funnily enough, that's exactly what we are doing today as well. In this sense, we're trying to make sense of what history tells us in order to understand the present, right? So, which again is the job of a historian, I guess. But funnily enough, we also speak just 2 days before the 4th of July, right? So, with that in mind, the era of Washington and the foundation itself is passing. We're heading towards the 19th century. What kind of narrative of this founding and the U.S. democracy have people been taken into the 19th century? Where are we in the beginning? Because when I try to look ahead, like in the middle of the century, for example, we have all these revolutions sweeping Europe just before, obviously, the Civil War itself in the U.S. So there's a lot of upheaval all over the place, but just before that, where are we there?
I think we need to be clear about the reality of democracy in early America. Like, what does democracy mean in like early America? I mean, you know, late 18th, early 19th century America.
Yeah.
It's interesting that the founders generally worried about too much democracy. The Constitution from 1787 is in many ways, if you compare it to the state constitutions that had emerged after the Declaration of Independence, was already an attempt to dial that back a little bit, to stem the tide of what they perceived as sort of too much revolutionary democratic energy. That's where all these counter-majoritarian elements come in, the Electoral College, the Senate, which is clearly not a representative institution, the Supreme Court, of course, right? So, one way that manifests that this sort of sense that there was maybe too much democracy was there is no affirmative right to vote in the Constitution, right? Instead, the details of voting are left to the states. Article 1 of the Constitution says the times, places, and manner of holding elections for senators and representatives shall be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof. And basically, in almost all the states, that meant only white men with property. So land-owning white men were allowed to vote. Now, it's interesting that by the middle of the 19th century, the right to vote had actually been extended to most white men, even without property, which is, by contemporaneous international standards, pretty democratic, actually, right? That goes much further than most, you know, the situation most of Europe or whatever. Mm. But this obviously excluded large chunks of the population, Black people, Native Americans, women. This was a white man's democracy, clearly, until after the Civil War, when there was an attempt, at least, to make it into something else. That's sort of the big push that comes after the Civil War with the so-called Reconstruction Amendments. But not until then, this is a white man's democracy.
And then we're heading towards the Civil War, fighting over what kind of union they want to be. Funnily enough, because you just talked about this before, we don't look at it from a contemporary perspective, obviously, but from today's perspective. And you talked about how it is told or how it is tried to be taken up as a subject that can be rewritten somewhat. I think especially of Nikki Haley's commentary that, for example, the Civil War wouldn't have been about slavery. There's stuff like that coming from the ultra-conservative side. What do you make of that?
Well, it's complete nonsense, of course, but no one was clearer about the fact that the Civil War was about slavery, of about defending the right to enslave human beings, than the seceding sovereign states, who explicitly said this, all of them, in their, announcements of why they succeeded, said, "Well, it's because of slavery, right?" I mean, this is all nonsense, of course. But it is interesting what happens after the Civil War. If we talk about democracy, this is sort of the big moment, right? Because after the Civil War, in quick succession between 1865 and 1870, the Constitution is amended. There are three amendments: the 13th Amendment abolishing slavery, the 14th Amendment establishing the right of citizenship for Black people and equality before the law, and the 15th Amendment establishing the right to vote for Black men. This is confined to men. This was the first attempt to actually establish a multiracial, or at that point, I should say, biracial democracy. I mean, this was such a profound change in American history. The historian Eric Foner has called it, rightfully so, I think, the second founding, right? So basically, there is an America before the Reconstruction Amendments, and there is one after. And the one after is significantly different from the one before. This was such a remarkable experiment in biracial democracy. I mean, imagine this, right? So this is just one example. In 1868, this is just 3 years after the end of the Civil War, South Carolina, the heart of the defeated Confederacy, elected a majority Black state legislature. That is remarkable, absolutely remarkable. However, the white supremacist counter-mobilization against that was swift and it was brutal. Reconstruction was, within just a few years, extinguished by a combination of ostensibly race-neutral laws that actually excluded Black people from voting, excluded them from participating in the political process, that also mandated complete racial segregation, and an enormous level of violence. I mean, exact numbers are hard to get, but we must assume that tens of thousands of Black people were killed, brutally assaulted, publicly executed in the final third of the 19th century. And the result of that was what we call the Jim Crow South. So a system of complete racial segregation, a white supremacist apartheid state within the United States. This was an authoritarian one-party rule regime. In most of the South, the Republican Party isn't even on the ballot for most of the Jim Crow South era. By about 1940, only about 4% of Black people are even registered to vote in the South. And the percentage of Black people who dare to actually vote was much smaller still because of the level of violent threat. So if you look at the height of Reconstruction, say around the late 1860s, it wasn't until at least 100 years later that America would reach that level of democracy again, which I think should be a really important reminder for everyone who talks about, consolidated established democracies, they never go back. Well, this country has actually gone back quite significantly. And again, it took about 100 years to even get back to the level of Reconstruction democracy.
Due to recent events, when we're talking and thinking about the role of a president during crucial times, when it comes to threats to democracy and the thriving towards something of a more democratic system, and also someone who is held up as a figure of pride and to someone to look towards, that is obviously always connected with Abraham Lincoln, someone who's, I think, just straight in line from George Washington to Lincoln to the presidents of the 20th century, when it comes to those are the ones you hold up. When we're looking at it again from today's perspective, with what has just happened recently, Donald Trump speaks about Abraham Lincoln a lot because he compares himself to him all the time. I mean, he says and does a lot of stupid things, and we don't have to give our precious time now to trying to contextualize that, but why him? Where do you think that comes from? Is it just one of the names he remembers?
Well, in Trump's case, I mean, yeah, look, people revere Lincoln, and he's like, "Oh, that's awesome, Abe Lincoln.
Huge
A big
statue.
monument. He has a big monument. I want a big monument." No, but there's something interesting, I guess, about Lincoln, because obviously Lincoln was a Republican president, right? So the Republican Party emerges in the 1850s specifically in opposition to slavery. It was split, the Republican Party was split between sort of, they called themselves radical Republicans who wanted to properly abolish slavery and institute a biracial democracy, and more sort of moderate Republicans who maybe mostly wanted to keep slavery confined to where it was and sort of, you know, prevent the further spread of slavery across the nation. Lincoln actually goes through quite a significant development. At the start of the Civil War, he's 100% clear. He isn't fighting this war to abolish slavery. He is fighting it to keep the Union together, to save the Union. And when he says, like, I'm paraphrasing slightly here, like, if I had to sort of accept slavery for the rest of eternity to save the Union, I would do it, right? But he evolves, right? So by the end of the Civil War, he is in a very different place. He clearly has decided that the Union cannot be saved. The Union cannot be kept together as long as the nation is divided into one part that is free and one part that is a slave state. So he has decided that slavery needs to go, actually. And by the end of the Civil War, he is also quite explicit about the fact that the people who are responsible for this, the system of slavery itself, need to be punished. And so, yeah, I mean, so again, Lincoln is very explicit about this. But he, of course, is assassinated at the end of the Civil War in April 1865. And so at first, it falls to his vice president, Andrew Johnson, who is not at all on Lincoln's side on this. Like, he thinks all this, like, you know, he was a proper white supremacist. Like, his politics was defined by white supremacy. And so he tries to actually block and sabotage the attempts to reconstruct the South, to establish a democratic system in the South. But, you know, he's overruled by Congress because the radical Republicans have a clear majority in Congress at the time. And so this is sort of the congressional reconstruction. And then after Johnson, the next president is Ulysses S. Grant. And he looks at the unbelievable level of violence and the white supremacist violence against black people and stuff. He's like, this cannot stand. And he sends in the troops, right? He sends in the U.S. military for quite some time, for several years. The U.S. military is an occupying force in the former Confederacy, tasked with, you know, making sure that democracy is actually being enacted in the South. Mm-hmm. But again, that falters once U.S. Grant leaves the office. And again, his successor, again, once again, is sort of making a deal with the people who don't want any of this reconstruction business and thinks it has gone too far. So Lincoln was a Republican president, and there is this weird thing amongst sort of right-wing activists who want to present at the sort of the Democratic Party as the real racists. Oh, look, it's actually the Democrats were actually the party of Jim Crow, which is true. Like, again, it is 100% true, right? But that, of course, completely misses the point, because the Democratic Party today has nothing to do with the so-called Dixiecrat, the Southern Democrats, who were the party of white supremacy and white apartheid in the South. This is again, for purely historical contingent reasons, the Republican Party was, no one wanted to vote for the Republican Party in the South. That was the party of Lincoln. That was the party of Northern aggression. And so it was the Democratic Party in itself. But the Democratic Party until the 1960s was basically two parties in one. There was a more liberal Northern Democratic Party, and then there was the so-called Dixiecrats in the South. And they were this sort of weird, very bizarre coalition with each other. But that ends the moment the Democratic Party, Democratic leadership decides to actually accept civil rights, to actually accept biracial democracy. And that starts this process that goes over decades of sort of what we call party realignment and partisan sorting, where these Dixiecrats, these, again, people whose politics is defined by white supremacy, they leave the Democratic Party and they find their new home in the Republican Party, where they have been in charge for quite some time now. So the party of Lincoln is not today's Republican Party, right? Mm-hmm. And the party of Jim Crow is not today's Democratic Party, even though, again, at a very, very superficial institutional level, that is correct. But that's, I think, what these people on the right want to sort of refer to when they say, oh, party of Lincoln and the Democrats are the real racists. But, I mean, again, historically speaking, this is complete and utter nonsense.
Now, like with this in mind, then coming into the 20th century, when we're talking about narratives and talking about a self-image, self-portray of a democratic nation, with what you described as the aftermath of the Civil War, when you like with the violence, but also with the now really established, or even though it has just been there has just been a war with all the casualties and all the destruction and the violence there, now it emerges that that is hard to overcome. It will be hard to overcome for many, many years to come. You described that at least 100 years, also legislatively. Right. This is a very, very tough word. So there's it's going to be difficult to put that into law, let alone into people's heads. But how do did actually the US come out of that with still the self-image of a democratic nation? What did they do?
I mean, it's quite interesting, right? That throughout the 20th century, certainly during the Cold War, the contrast is quite striking between a nation that presents itself on the global stage as the defender of freedom and democracy, and
Especially
understanding
when
that.
heading towards the world wars, when fighting off barbarism, right?
No, absolutely. The fighting fascism, that fighting Hitler and that kind of stuff. And again, this is sort of an understanding that is just, it tells you who, I mean, this is a white mainstream understanding of America. It's a white elite American perception of America, right? This was never shared by Black people. This was never shared by Native Americans, right? So up until the 1960s, this was a fairly democratic society if you happened to be a white man, but something else entirely if you were not. It is interesting to think about the relationship between the Cold War, for instance, and democracy, which is once again quite complicated because in some ways it certainly inhibited democracy in some important ways. It enabled the establishment of a national security state that is almost entirely removed from democratic control. It also fueled anti-communist hysteria that was used to stifle and purge any form of dissent and to label any attempt at sort of leveling discriminatory hierarchies as communism. But on the other hand, it also helped the democratization in some way. So, for instance, one reason why the civil rights movement found a more sympathetic ear in Washington in the early 1960s was that the Kennedy administration was very much worried about US prestige on the global scale. And it certainly didn't look good for America to be attacking the Soviet Union about a lack of freedom and democracy, only for the Soviet Union to rightfully say, what about black people in your own country, right? So, and so one other thing is that the Cold War, interestingly, inhibited certain openly aggressive anti-democratic voices and movements. Like, for instance, openly siding against democracy, even in the Republican Party in the 1980s, that got you ostracized from the mainstream. There is, and there has always been, a more openly sort of ethno-nationalist America First tradition that was very strong in the 1940s, but it was hampered by exactly this, right? As long as we are doing this Cold War thing, we can't have you run around openly say that you despise democracy. It is not a coincidence that the end of the Cold War in the early 90s is precisely the moment when these right-wing voices and traditions are moving closer to the Republican mainstream, when these, we call them paleo-conservative sometimes, there's a far-right ethno-nationalist ideas and people, they find an opening to make their case against democracy. The end of the Cold War again opened the doors for them in many ways. There's an interesting figure, a guy called Joe Sobran, sort of a paleo-conservative commentator, longtime columnist for the National Review, also an aggressive anti-Semite, who wrote in the early 90s, this is 1990, early 92, he says, now that the, this is a direct quote, now that democracy has overthrown communism, we can turn to the problem of how to overthrow democracy, right? So for these people on the right, again, they were always part of the right-wing coalition, but they were somewhat hampered by the sort of anti-communist Cold War. But now they felt like, okay, awesome, we defeated communism. Now we can turn to what they saw as the real enemy, which was sort of any attempt to, again, level hierarchies of race and gender and wealth and religion. And that, I think, is, in that sense, the post-Cold War moment, the end of the Cold War, plays a crucial role in the emergence of Trumpism as a political phenomenon that sort of takes over the right-wing mainstream.
When we come to that, when I think about the Cold War, but actually also before, particularly in the Second World War with fighting fascism and all the idea of actually we go over there and save the day because they can't handle it themselves. So we are this birth of the world police idea that the US is actually called upon whenever there's a fire is also in my in my view, and also in my experience, like back in the days when I studied history, it came to mind very often that this is also the extreme focalization of the idea of them and us, right? So this idea of us as Democrats, or like small d Democrats, and the otherness idea of strengthening your own identity by defining it, like with a distinct line of what the others are. And especially, and this also kind of links to today's problems in the US, or at least what comes to people's minds when they are interviewed about their own economic troubles or something. It is easy apparently for populists to exercise this idea of, as long as there's a threat towards us, right? The identity strengthens, and we can forget about our own domestic troubles or internal troubles. So this is something that I deeply connect with the time of the Cold War. Can you follow me on that?
I would push back against that a little bit because, as sort of as inconsistent and in many way hypocritical, the idea of like, we're defending freedom and democracy over there fighting fascism as again as clearly sort of hypocritical in many ways as that was, it also installed, at least in sort of again mainstream politics, a kind of anti-fascist consensus in American politics that you could at least. If you could brand someone or something as fascist, right, or fascist adjacent, that was a way to kind of ostracize them from mainstream politics. And by the way, this is what there's a strong sort of black anti-fascist tradition that does exactly this. They understand, look, if this country, if this is a thing that we are defining ourselves as the sort of anti-fascist force in the world, then we can point to things here in America on the domestic front, right? And make use of that and say, okay, then what about this? That's also pretty fascist, right? So I think this sort of anti-fascist consensus, again, as inconsistent as it was, and as sort of, again, as hypocritical as it was in many ways, it was useful, right? It was useful for those who wanted to democratize American society. And I think it is a problem that today this has clearly broken down. I mean, there is no more anti-fascist consensus. I mean, now someone like Trump and the people around him, they constantly say and do things that would have gotten you ostracized from mainstream politics not that long ago. And that's just not the case anymore. And I think we were better off when that still happened, right? So in that sense, I think there was something to this kind of again anti-fascist consensus that at least as a as an idea as something that could be invoked was still sort of out there.
And when we think about, well, the time of the Cold War, and especially with all the troubles, you were before saying that it took another 100 years to actually overcome mostly, at least officially, segregation in most parts of the country, trying to set the precedents and also then putting it into law to at least try and thrive towards making people more equal. That at the same time, while being like in a Cold War with Russia, what did that do to the self-portrayal of the US as a democracy?
I mean, it's interesting, right? So in many ways, so the 1960s civil rights legislation is the moment when, for the first time ever, with the very brief exception of the Reconstruction era, America becomes something that has a claim, a reasonable claim, to be a pluralistic democracy, as imperfect as it always has been. And so in many ways, I think liberal America, for instance, has basically replaced 1776 as kind of the origin moment with 1965 as the origin moment, right? So it's very, I think it's a sort of a standard, the standard tale amongst liberal Americans has basically become, yeah, so until 1965, there was no democracy and it was really bad. But since 1965, it's been pretty good, right? So, or at least since 1965, the country is sort of irrevocably on the path towards, the real democracy and all that kind of stuff. And then you hear all this stuff that sort of Obama was very fond of invoking, sort of the moral arc of the universe bending towards justice, all that kind of ahistorical nonsense. So it is true, right? It is true that this is an absolutely crucial moment. And again, I'll say this again. America does become a multiracial, pluralistic democracy, one with many, many, many remaining issues, but something different from what it was before the civil rights legislation of the 1960s. And no one is clearer about this than the people who don't like that, right? So, because in reaction to the civil rights legislation and to, again, the democratization of America in the 1950s and 60s, is sort of that's what modern conservatism emerges in reaction to. Like, modern conservatism as a political project arises in the middle decades of the 20th century as an alliance between different factions who agree on one thing, and that is democracy is bad, we don't want it, and so we need to fight it, right? So that is, they're staunchly opposed to any kind of leveling of traditional hierarchies of race and gender and religion and wealth. And so that is, again, that's what defines modern conservatism as a political project. And the problem is that these conservatives, so defined, again, in their opposition to pluralistic democracy, have since the 1970s become the dominating voice within the Republican Party. And so the Republican Party has also become a party that, you know, a party whose overriding concern since at least the 1970s has been precisely this, stemming the onslaught, quote-unquote onslaught, of pluralistic democracy, turning the clock back. And I think, again, from there, clearly, a pretty clear line goes to where we are today.
Exactly. And this is the question towards the end of that arc, at that particular arc, not the arc towards justice, but the arc towards some justice that has been ruled yesterday. You said where we are today and the threats towards what kind of democracy we're talking about. This is interesting. And I really like that you pointed out the different differences in definition, right? Like back in the day when it was founded, back in the 19th century, back in 20th century, and how it's changed with 1965, and basically today. So what kind of democracy, like, let's say the status quo from today, not in a year from now, what kind of democracy are we talking about in the US?
I mean, look, whenever someone says democracy, the next question should be what kind of democracy and how much and for whom, right? This is the defining conflict in many ways throughout American history. There has always been, really since the founding, this idea that is embodied in this of all men are created equal, all people are created equal. That is fundamentally an egalitarian principle, right? All people are created equal. And obviously, a lot of work had to be done and still needs to be done to expand this idea of who gets to belong in that category, the people. But still, it's ultimately a vision of an egalitarian, democratic, pluralistic democracy, right? Pluralistic in terms of religion, ethnicity, race, and egalitarian in terms of, you know, in terms of the individual status not being defined by race, gender, religion, or wealth, right? So that is one sort of part of the equation. But there was always an opposing vision, which was that America is actually not defined by this egalitarian principle, but that it is a nation of and for white Christians, where wealthy white male Christians get to be at the top and get to define what is and what is not, quote unquote, real America. This is in many ways the defining conflict throughout American history, right? And so in many ways, we are living through the latest iteration of that conflict, of that sort of broader framework. And I think, again, the question since Trump came down the golden elevator, I don't know if people remember this, in 2015. Escalator. Yes. Not elevator.
Elevator would have been quite fun as well. Yeah.
Much more impressive to come down the escalator. To announce that he was running for president. Ever since that moment, the question has been, or there have been two opposing narratives about this moment. Was that just an aberration? Is Trump an aberration, sort of an accidental departure from kind of a noble, venerable tradition of conservatism? Or is this just the mask coming off, right? Is this just what it's always been? And underneath the mask has always been this sort of kind of vindictive, revenge-seeking, grievance-driven, white ethno-nationalist movement. And I think, again, from a historical perspective, the truth is somewhere in between, but I'm leaning more towards the interpretation that emphasizes continuities, while also we have to grapple, because again, there are long-standing anti-democratic tendencies and impulses on the right. And Donald Trump is sort of in tradition of that, right? Or Trumpism as a political phenomenon is in tradition of that. That being said, there has also been a significant radicalization of the right over the past few, 15 years or so, or in the 21st century, because the country has moved away from their vision of white Christian patriarchal dominance, right? Due to political, cultural, most importantly, demographic developments. This project of preserving quote unquote real America as a white Christian patriarchal homeland, that has come under enormous pressure. And in reaction to that, the conservative political project has radicalized, or a better way to say this is more radical voices and factions that were always part of the right-wing coalition have been able to pull the whole right-wing coalition towards a more radical politics. And I think the rise of Trump and Trumpism is best understood not as the cause, but as the manifestation of this radicalization that has, again, significantly accelerated in the 21st century, certainly accelerated in reaction to the election of the first black president in 2008. It has once again accelerated in reaction to the mass protests in the wake of the George Floyd murder in 2020. And so, again, significant radicalization, but not a departure, not a complete sort of, this is not an accident, what we're seeing here on the right. In many ways, it is very much in line with longstanding anti-democratic traditions and impulses on the right.
We have just a couple of minutes left here, and so where do the conservatives actually want to take us back? We talked briefly before we started about this, and you said actually not 1776, basically, if you want to use that date as something like of a milestone or something. But where do we actually want to be? If I think of Mike Johnson, for example, and his project ideas, then I figure, yeah, it's actually taking us back to some sort of white Christian rule.
Yeah, I mean, clearly, I mean, very explicitly so, right? The people who are in charge on the right, the people who are in charge in the Republican Party, are 100% clear and explicit that they think the path that America has been on since the 1960s has been a mistake. They want to repeal the civil rights order, the civil rights legislation. There's no question about it. And in many ways, I think what we see on the Supreme Court is they want to go even further. They basically want to take the country back to before the Reconstruction Amendment. Now, when I say this, I don't mean this as they want to reinstitute slavery. That's not what I mean. But what the Reconstruction Amendments basically did was they reframed the role of government and the role of the state from basically, up until then, privileging the rights and privileges of those who were already at the top, and that means white wealthy men, to basically giving the state and government sort of the task of actually overcoming that and actually sort of moving the country towards that which it has often promised, but actually never has been yet, which is that kind of actually sort of egalitarian, multiracial, pluralistic democracy. That is the big shift that happens with the Reconstruction. The Reconstruction Amendments redefine, right? Redefine the key task. They redefine the Constitution from one that sort of entrenches existing hierarchies and power relations to one that is actually the task is to overcome that towards multiracial pluralistic democracy. And I think there's no question that the people who are in charge of the Supreme Court, people who are in charge of the Republican Party, they think that's a mistake. And so they want to go back to before that.
And they figure that that is actually possible in some, let's put it in the way of how the demographic, for example, changed in the US over the last, let's say, 50, 60 years. Who is voting and where? We're not talking about gerrymandering and the ways they can actually influence how the votes are counted and how the Electoral College is messing the whole thing up. But still, I mean, things have changed since the 1960s. So how to go back there?
Well, look, there's no question that the majority of Americans, the clear majority of Americans, opposes this vision that the American right wants to impose on the country. No question, right? But the question of whether or not a sort of a radicalizing minority can get away with this attempt to sort of cling to power, right? It hinges entirely on how far this radicalizing minority is willing to go to cling to power, right? And so, yeah, I mean, if you're telling me that, yeah, no, they're going to respect the results of elections and they're going to respect majority will and all that, then yeah, sure. Then they cannot cling to power. But I mean, this is the calculation that the American right has made, right? The Republican Party as well. Faced with a situation in which their vision for America is just no longer going to generate majorities, right? They're not going to get majority support for their vision of white Christian patriarchal America. It doesn't work anymore because the demographics of the country have changed so much. Mm-hmm. So in that situation, they're faced with, well, the choice of either sort of changing their visions, of going away from that vision, accepting a more pluralistic democratic society, or relinquishing power, accepting that you are not going to get power. But they have decided, oh, hey, wait, now how about we do something else? We just get rid of this democracy thing, right? Because if you don't have democracy, then this whole majority will thing doesn't faze you all that much. So that is the calculation they have made. If this were a functioning democratic system, right, they would have to either get away from their vision of white Christian patriarchal dominance or relinquish power. But they have found a third choice, which is, how about we just get rid of democracy? And again, if you ask me, but can they really get away with this? Then my answer is, it depends on how far they're willing to go to impose that vision. And I think everything we've seen over the past few years is that they are willing to go quite far, that they're not going to have an epiphany that says, oh, maybe we shouldn't go that far. That's not going to happen, right? It's very clearly, this is the permission structure that has governed conservative politics over the past few years, clearly is to say any measure, regardless of how extreme, is justified if it comes in defense of quote-unquote real America, because they really believe they are the noble defenders of quote-unquote real America in an existential struggle against quote-unquote un-American forces of leftism and wokeism and all the globalism. And that, again, they have given themselves permission to go as far as they need to go to defend quote-unquote real America. So I don't see them just stop. They will be stopped, or they will succeed at entrenching these hierarchies.
With that in mind, I'm thinking about my last question here. What now? What is happening now? Because if Democrats are one thing, they're usually shy from really going all the way to doing unusual things, right? The Democrats are usually shy from going to the extreme when it comes to what they could actually do to, for example, try to bring to court more of the things that they accused Trump of doing over the last 3 years, right? And they didn't do that. Or at least Garland wasn't a figure in that, because he recused himself from that, and everybody said that it's the right thing to do, but he mustn't have done it, right? So what is happening now until November? Is everybody going to call upon everybody to actually go out and vote, because that's the only thing to stop fascism?
I mean, we are probably left with a situation in which defeating Donald Trump yet again at the ballot box and hoping that they're actually somehow going to accept the result of a democratic election this time is the only way to go. But that in and of itself is the fact that this is where we are, that he will have to be defeated at the ballot box again, is the result of a complete and disastrous failure of the American institutions to hold him and the people who have helped him and who have enabled him accountable in any way for trying to overthrow the last democratic election. We should not be in this situation. It's a complete and utter failure of all the institutions that are nominally, ostensibly tasked with defending American democracy, starting with, yes, the current administration, the Democratic Party leadership, the American media. I mean, we just had this utterly stupid debate thing, which this should never have happened. There should not have been a presidential debate in which fundamentally you're treating Donald Trump, CNN treated Donald Trump as a quote-unquote normal presidential candidate. Right?
Yeah.
That is the message, right? If you're putting, this is just playing, it's just presidential politics as usual, or like election season as usual. We're doing presidential debate and we're going to have Trump and Biden because they're the presidential nominees. And then for the first 40 minutes or so, they just talk about the national deficit and the economy and all this quote unquote, again, normal, right? Normal politics stuff. But that's in and of itself a devastating indictment of the institutions that they haven't been able and or willing. Some haven't been able, some haven't been willing to again hold Trump and those who have enabled him accountable in any way. Like, again, imagine someone had told you this in, say, January 7, 2021, a day after the assault, the violent assault on the Capitol, that was just the last phase of a multi-level, multi-week campaign to nullify the results of a democratic election, to stage an auto coup. Imagine someone had told you the day after, you know what, in four years from now, Trump is not going to have had to pay any price for this. There's not going to be any accountability whatsoever. And he's just going to be the Republican nominee again. And as of right now, he's going to have a better than 50-50 chance to actually be reelected to the office of president. I think you and I and everyone would have said, well, that's a disaster. And that probably means that American democracy has absolutely and utterly failed. And yes, that is precisely the situation in which we find ourselves. And again, this complete and utter lack of, it's been 2 years since the Dobbs ruling, almost exactly 2 years since the Dobbs ruling, again, in which the Supreme Court overruled Roe v. Wade and abolished the right to abortion, the right to bodily autonomy. And the Democratic Party, the Biden administration, Democratic leadership, they haven't come up with any response to that. That is sort of in any way commensurate with the problem. They keep talking about, safeguarding trust in the institutions, which is utterly inadequate when the problem is precisely that one of the major institutions, the Supreme Court, is the spearhead of this reactionary mobilization, this reactionary assault on modern democracy and the modern state. And so just to keep talking about, the trust in the institution, it's just not good enough and it's not going to work. And so they just keep saying, you got to vote. And yes, I mean, look, don't get me wrong. Absolutely. 100%. Right. There is no question. People have to vote because this is the fundamental reality of American politics. The struggle over whether or not America should be a democracy, over whether or not the democratic experiment should continue, now maps onto the conflict between the two major parties. That is the fundamental reality. Democracy itself has become a partisan issue in the United States. There is currently only one major party that qualifies as a small D Democratic Party, and that is, for all its many faults, the capital D Democratic Party. And that also means for the foreseeable future, the fate of democracy is on the ballot in every single election. And the problem is that those who seek to subvert and abolish democracy might only have to win once to get what they want. And with this Supreme Court ruling from yesterday, I think it's very clear to say that if they win in November and Donald Trump gets back to the White House, well, democracy, again, in the very, very not perfect form in which it currently exists, it will be over in the United States of America for the foreseeable future. Whatever you want to label what comes after, right? Whatever you want to call that, it would be a form of authoritarian minority rule, and it would turn this country into a place that is vastly more hostile towards pluralism and multiracial democracy, and anyone who deviates from this vision of white Christian patriarchal dominance. And those are the stakes in the election in November. And again, a functioning, healthy democratic system should not ever be in a situation like this, in which that is actually on the ballot, and those are the stakes. But those are the stakes.
Those are the stakes. There's no point sugarcoating this. And there's also no point saying anymore, I guess. I think you made the final statement quite clear and quite alarming. But then again, this is where we are, and this is what we have to face. Well, you won't be voting, right? Since you're not a citizen.
No, I'm a German. So, I'm a German citizen. Yeah. I do not have US. Yeah, I cannot vote. No, but I will be here, and then we'll see what happens. I did say to my wife, you know, we're here with our two little kids, and I for the first time ever yesterday, I said to my wife, it is good that we do have these German passports. Right? Yeah, because I mean this sincerely, it could get quite bad quite quickly. And I understand that, you know, this can be, it is really hard to grapple with that and sort of to break through the kind of sense of there's a very strong normalcy bias in all of us. We just want to go through our normal lives and our normal routines. And to some extent, we have to we have to compartmentalize. Like, look, when we're done here, right? I'm going to go downstairs. My older son is sick today. He is home from summer camp because he has a fever. He's doing movie time. So I'm going to go downstairs. I'm going to spend the rest of the afternoon playing cards and dinosaurs and all that kind of stuff. And we're going to be happy and normal and all that kind of stuff. So we're all compartmentalizing to get through life. I totally understand that. But at the same time, we are in an acute crisis situation. And yeah, I mean, again, this is yesterday's ruling. Not that the situation wasn't bad enough as it was, but yesterday's ruling, I think, should be a reminder of what the stakes are in November.
Hopefully that actually brings people to the polls, and especially people who were planning on not voting, for example, because they're unhappy with either of the choices they have. Maybe now that's actually this whole argument of democracy is at stake, democracy is on the ballot, that President Biden obviously is playing that drum quite heavily, and rightly so. Hopefully that brings people actually to vote, and not as a protest not to vote. So that's the hope I think that many people now have while playing with their kids and trying to think of something else, at least for a change. And with that, my dear Thomas, thank you very much for taking the time, for all your insights, your knowledge, and for sharing that with me and with everybody listening today. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And with that, thanks again to the America Centrum, Lena, everybody from the staff for hosting this. Thank you to the ASME Institute for also hosting this in their Road to Election program. If you haven't done so, do check out the other events on their website. Actually, from, as Lena said, until January in 2025, there are events online and also some are live that you can check out and get more skilled and knowledgeable about the election and what is at stake, even though I guess Thomas basically said most of the things that you at least have to know if you still have question marks in your head about the importance of the upcoming election. Thanks to everybody listening, and thanks to everybody listening to it online later. So if you're thinking of sharing that afterwards with friends or family or colleagues or someone who hadn't had the opportunity to listen to today, you can do so once the America Central has uploaded that on the internet, and there it will stay until the sun blows out. Thank you, everybody, and see you next time.
If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, as well as the Chicago-Hamburg sister city relationship, why don't you visit us at our website, americazentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The Americazentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the Americazentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americazentrum.de. Thanks for listening.